Morning to you.
Morning, Stephen.
How are you doing today?
I'm not too bad at all.
Good stuff. You confident of this election?
Well, we didn't particularly want this election. We felt we had no option in relation to the DUP's behaviour in relation to the RHI scandal, their refusal to engage properly with any investigation into it and their attempt to dismiss and deny it. And so it's not ideal time to be going out to engage with the electorate in the middle of February. But nonetheless, I think that we have been hearing from people a very clear message that they are angry at what has been going on, that they want to see people held to account. They want to see devolution return, but they want to ensure that people are adhering to the principles of the Good Friday Agreement.
But you could have worked that through, couldn't you? You could have worked that crisis, if you want to call it that, through with the DUP. Well, instead, you insisted on Arlene Foster to step aside. And Michelle O'Neill's going further. She said she won't go back in until all the allegations against Arlene Foster are sorted.
Well, we
did. You don't dictate a unionist leader, do you?
Well, we're not attempting to dictate a unionist leader. What we did do pre-Christmas, when other people were calling for Arlene Foster's resignation, that was Mike Nesbitt and the SDLP, Martin McGuinness asked her privately to consider stepping aside for a period of time until a preliminary report was done into an investigation into the RHI
Why
scandal.
Why couldn't she have stayed in her job while there was an investigation?
Because the entire integrity of the executive was being placed under huge question marks and stress. And I think every revelation, every drip feed that has come out in relation to this story since Martin McGuinness took his decision to effectively suspend Arlene Foster from office has vindicated and justified that decision. And can I say, we are not in the business of saying who the leader of the DUP should be. If the DUP want Arlene Foster as their leader, that's a matter for themselves.
You required her to step aside from her ministerial position.
Yes, and that was a reasonable
request. Before anything was proven against her.
A reasonable request, one which has precedent in terms of her previous leader, Peter Robinson. A reasonable request. And what we're saying now is we're not dictating who the DUP pick as their leader, but what we're saying is until the investigation is complete, there's a cloud hanging over Arlene Foster. And not only would Sinn Féin not support her as going back in a role, a ministerial role, whether it be First Minister, Deputy First Minister, or any type of other minister, but I don't think any of the parties would support that.
So are you saying to me, can you honestly look me in the eye this morning and say to me that if there was a serious allegation against a Sinn Féin minister, they would step aside?
I think an allegation of that nature of corruption, which goes to the heart of...
There's no allegation of corruption against Arlene Foster.
There's an allegation of corruption in relation to the RHI scheme.
There's no allegation of corruption against Arlene Foster, and nothing has been proven.
There is an allegation of corruption in relation to the RHI scheme. It involves people operating out of the office of the First and Deputy First Minister. There is £500 million worth of funding potentially at threat as a consequence of this. And I think in those circumstances, and I think that's not just Sinn Féin's view. I think in those circumstances a reasonable request was for her to step aside. Our request...
Why couldn't she have stayed in there and have an investigation?
Because the integrity and the credibility of the executive was shot to pieces by the ongoing revelations, by the prospect of her former colleague, Jonathan Bell, slinging allegations at her, her slinging allegations back, the Minister for the Economy doing selective leaking to try and undermine his predecessor in that post. And all of that, I think, was hugely impacting on the credibility of the executive. And what it required was a bold initiative from Arlene Foster, and she wasn't capable or willing to take such an initiative.
You're in a sticky wicket this morning, being the person saying Arlene Foster should have stepped aside, aren't you? You personally.
Why would that be?
You were a minister in the Department for Regional Development, right?
That's correct, yeah.
During that time, a tribunal ruled that you appointed a head of Northern Ireland Water, Sean Hogan, because he was not from a Protestant background. When that tribunal was happening, investigating you, did you step aside?
When that tribunal was happening, investigating me, I wasn't a minister.
No, but did you step aside after they ruled?
I wasn't a minister at the time.
No, did you step aside from your party after they ruled?
No, I contest.
That you appointed someone because he was not from a Protestant background?
No, well, I contested that. The legal
and the tribunal found against you.
Okay, and the legal advice, which the then Minister for Regional Development, Danny Kennedy, a unionist minister, had, absolutely rubbished the finding of the tribunal, said no reasonable tribunal could have come to the conclusion that it did. It said the tribunal findings had no basis in law, yet he refused...
The tribunal finding said...
Sorry, can I finish?
There was material bias against the appointment of candidates from a Protestant background.
Yeah, and I absolutely and utterly deny that. And the record that I had when I was Minister for Regional Development absolutely refutes that. And can I say, the legal opinion in relation to her finding was scathing. The problem for me was, on a personal level, it was up to the department. I wasn't found guilty of anything. The department was, and it was up to the department to appeal. And the unionist minister for the department was prepared to let that finding stand rather than challenge it. The legal advice was that the tribunal finding had no basis in law and that no reasonable tribunal could have come to the finding that it did.
But that's what the tribunal found.
That's what the tribunal found.
And £150,000 of compensation was paid out to
unnecessarily, in my view.
But a tribunal found it.
Unnecessarily.
And you just moved on.
No, I didn't just move on. I sought to find ways in which I could challenge. But bear in mind, I was not the accused in this case. It was the department. The person running the department at that time, I had left
the department. Well, you were the minister.
I had left.
At the time of the appointment. Ministerial responsibility, Conor.
I had left the department by the time the tribunal was put in place.
No, when the appointment was made, you were the minister.
Yes.
And Sinn Féin like to talk about ministerial responsibility.
That's what I'm saying to you.
Did you have any?
Yes, I did, in terms of the appointment, and I defended the appointment. And by the time the tribunal was put in place to challenge that, I was no longer a minister. So the question of stepping aside never arose. And had I been the minister, Stephen, I would have challenged, I would have appealed that, and I wouldn't have willingly handed out that amount of compensation to the person on the other end of that case.
You claimed to that tribunal, didn't you, that you didn't know the religion of the applicants?
That's correct.
So you didn't know the religion of Sean Hogan. You didn't know that he was a Catholic.
I mean, why should I? Because his name was Sean Hogan. I should have presumed. Alan Lennon was the person who
appealed. Was he not known to you, Sean
Hogan?
Was
the person who appealed. I knew of him because he was involved in various... He was chair of the trust in my area at one stage. I never question anybody's religion when I meet them. I'm interested in them from their professional capacity.
It's just, I guess... Interesting, Conor, that here we have a tribunal deciding something and you're saying, well, you don't like the outcome of the tribunal, so therefore you will ridicule the outcome of the tribunal. Will you do the same if they're after a public inquiry, if indeed it finds something about Arlene Foster? No suggestion that it will, not for me to say that. But why can't she turn round and do what you did and say, I just don't like that result?
Well, firstly, it wasn't me.
And by the way, they might find her completely.
They may well do. It wasn't me that ridiculed. It wasn't me that ridiculed the final tribunal.
You have done this morning.
Senior legal advice. I'm quoting you. Senior legal advice, which said that no reasonable tribunal could have come to the conclusion it did, and that the findings had no basis in fact. And what I'm saying to you is, on that basis of that senior legal advice to a government department, I would have appealed that. I would have appealed that finding. If a judge-led, and we set up this judge-led inquiry, and purposely on a basis of not to interfere, then we will accept whatever the findings of the judge-led inquiry are in relation to the RHI scandal.
I am going to move on from this, but just there was just one last thing, given what's happened with RHI, that intrigued me about this. Because the permanent secretary at the time, now the head of the civil service, Malcolm McKibben, was not aware of the situation, right? You hadn't consulted with the permanent secretary at all during the appointment, right?
You're back on the tribunal finding, yeah.
Correct.
Well, I'm not sure whether he was aware. I would imagine that the permanent secretary, there was a changeover of permanent secretary at that time in the department, whether Malcolm McKibben was in place at that time.
No, I'm talking about when you were making the appointment. You hadn't consulted with the permanent secretary.
The procedure was for appointments was that you were handed a shortlist of... applicants who met the criteria, and from that shortlist you picked someone. That was the procedure for appointment within the department.
And the tribunal found that you picked someone because they were not a Protestant. Conor.
Well, I absolutely refute that. And as I say,
looking at your front page of the manifesto,
my record of appointments within that department supports my theory that that was not the case at all. And the legal opinion in relation to the tribunal finding actually underpinned that it should have been properly appealed, and that money should not have been handed out to the applicant.
Let's move on. Michelle O'Neill last night. At a commemoration for some IRA men. Clonoe, let's just hear what the leader of your party said.
There are some who would say we have no right to remember or to honour them. We have absolutely every right. Everyone, it doesn't matter who you are, has the right to remember their dead in a respectful and dignified manner.
These are four IRA men who went out to kill, correct?
That's correct.
In the dead of night. With a machine gun shooting all around them. And in 2017, the new leader of your party wants to remember them. Is she celebrating what they did?
I have no idea whether she celebrated what they did, but remembrance is something which is a contested area. But nonetheless, her predecessor, Martin McGuinness, had conducted many commemorations. There are hundreds of commemorations annually for people who were killed in the conflict, including IRA volunteers. Martin McGuinness has commemorated many of them. He also went to the Somme to commemorate those who died in conflicts there. The Queen went to Dublin to commemorate those who were involved in the IRA in the 1920s, who took on the British state, went out to kill people, were killed themselves. She honoured those people. This is an area, I think, where people, if they're genuine in terms of reconciliation, need to give space and recognition that the death of people in whatever side of the conflict they're on is still a very poignant and emotional affair for many people, including their families, and that what we ask in all cases, including those who remember people who were killed with the British state forces or any other people who were killed in the conflict, is that it is done with respect and it is done with sensitivity.
And for the police officers, that was 1992, quite a while ago, for the police officers who may still be alive, who were inside that night when these IRA men being commemorated, being remembered by your leader, they may be suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. They may be completely screwed up because of that night, because these four men went out with a machine gun, tried to kill them. Do you think they will feel Michelle O'Neill is for them as well as anyone else when she's remembering those assassins?
Well, I think that people... It depends on what people's personal experience is of conflict, and I'm sure the families of those four IRA volunteers are even more traumatised by what happened to their sons and brothers. But I think that anyone who wants to see a way forward recognises that commemoration events, as the royal family have recognised, as the British state have recognised, as political leaders have recognised, commemoration events need to be treated sensitively, that people are entitled to remember their own dead in a respectful way, and that we need to give space to allow people to do that.
Why are they her dead?
Who's dead?
Michelle O'Neill's. Why does she align herself to them? Why did she go down
because
to do that?
Because they,
why do they mean something to her?
Because they are neighbours of hers. Their families are neighbours of hers. She's from Clonoe, a small place in County Tyrone. These young men were from that area. They were killed in that area. I'm sure she knows the families personally. And so it is a communal thing as well as a political thing, where people in your village, in your community, were killed as a consequence of the conflict. And I think that applies to anyone who wishes to commemorate, whether they be British state forces, people from the loyalist community. I think of these commemorations, we need to give space for them to happen. We need to allow people to remember their dead with dignity and respect.
And does she stand equally by the police officers that night who those four IRA men were trying to kill? Or does she stand more by the IRA men?
I don't think there's any measurement of one against the other. What she stands
for... So she
for,
does stand equally
no, what I'm saying,
by the police officers,
what I'm saying
she?
For... I mean, this is not a simple game of an equation.
It is actually because in the front of your manifesto is equality.
Absolutely.
So I'm asking about equality for those police officers who those young men tried to kill.
And if people want to give treatment or respect or acknowledge any suffering that those police officers happened on that occasion, then they should be free to do
but
so.
But there's my question about equality. Would Michelle O'Neill go?
Go
if there was some type of event which said, do you know what, that night was so traumatic for those police officers, a machine gun spraying into a police station.
Yeah, and those,
would Michelle O'Neill align herself with the trauma of those police officers as victims of that night or not?
Well, she has demonstrated, as has Sinn Féin, time and time again, a willingness to reach out, to respect other traditions, to engage and contribute to reconciliation, not gesture politics, but genuine reconciliation. We have met many victims. I've met people in the British Army who have come into South Armagh who were engaged in armed activity there, were traumatised by what happened to them. We have met them. We have talked to them. We have showed them our respect, tried to assist them in terms of dealing with the trauma and revisiting events that happened to them. Republicans privately and publicly have been prepared to do that all over the years because we know it is in the interest of reconciliation and healing society. So we have not been found wanting in that regard. And it's not simply a matter of measuring one incident against another. It's a general approach to how we deal with the past.
Yeah, and we will move on into the future. I do want to do that. But I just guess there may be some people from within the unionist community who may feel that Sinn Féin is currently talking about, you know, the scandal of an uncapped scheme. Well, that was about money. Mm-hmm. You can't compare money to life.
No.
There was no cap on that machine gun when those IRA men were trying to kill those police officers, was there?
No.
As many bullets as possible, Connor.
Nor was there a
And the IRA men hoped that it hit the police officers in the head and killed them, didn't it?
And nor was
and that's what Michelle O'Neill was commemorating last night.
Nor was there any cap on the weapons that the SAS used to kill those four young men. And that's the tragedy of the conflict that we've been through. So either we get bogged down in trying to heighten sensitivities around it, or we try and publicly and privately, as we have been doing for many, many years, make gestures and moves towards reconciliation and understand and have difficult conversations with people about Republicans' role in conflict, make sure people understand our approach to our history throughout all of this period, and ensure that anything that is done in a public fashion or a private fashion is done in a respectful way.
You were in the IRA. The IRA in 2002 apologised to the civilian victims of its, for its campaign of violence. It didn't apologise to combatants. Should it have done?
No, I think it went as far as the IRA could do at the time. The IRA no longer exists. But I think what we have done in terms of the legacy arrangements that we have agreed at Stormont House and at Fresh Start Agreement is we have tried to put together mechanisms which respectfully deal with the issues relating to the conflict and people who are injured in the conflict. And that is one that Sinn Féin have signed up to. That is one that we expect Republicans to participate fully in. And the difficulty that we have in relation to all that is that the British government have yet to sign up to it and allow the mechanisms to move forward.
The reason I'm going over this again is because there are some people saying that in this election there may be some people who in the past have voted unionist who may actually reach out to Sinn Féin. They may actually look at some of your policies and think, do you know what? Lying under the past, let's move on. And that's why I'm just trying to probe your understanding of what may have been a traditional anger towards Sinn Féin supporting the IRA's campaign of violence. That's why I'm doing this.
I've encountered some of those people on my canvas. I've heard from people who are from the unionist community. I was stopped by a man from East Belfast in Newry the other day who told me that himself and his friends were tactically voting Sinn Féin in this election because they were angry at the DUP. And I appreciate that and I acknowledge that. And I think we have acknowledged time and time again that Republican activities have caused hurt in the unionist community and that we need to find a way to try and deal with all of that to heal the pain of the past.
So let's just get an understanding of where Sinn Féin is. Let's take one example in the past. A well-known one. 1979, was Lord Louis Mountbatten a non-combatant when he was blown up in that boat?
Well, I was only a teenager at the time, so I wasn't aware of the rationale that went into the operation at that stage. It was a tragedy because not only was he killed, but other people who were not associated with the royal family or with British military history or the British military establishment were killed.
But because he was associated, did that make him a legitimate target?
Well, I presume.
Is that Sinn Féin's current position?
No, I presume in the eyes of the people who went out to kill him, they considered him a legitimate target at that time because he was a member of the British military establishment.
He's your former colleague, so I'm asking what Sinn Féin's current position. If you're talking to some of those people this morning wondering what your party's about, looking back in the past, you know, it was a 14-year-old child and a 15-year-old child blown up in that boat.
Yes. That was indefensible. Yes. But what I'm saying is we recognise that there a great deal of hurt has been caused in the past, including hurt by Republicans. Now, we can pick through each incident and try and find out what we think is the most poignant or what we think is the most illustrates the most. And I could go over a range of incidents from a Republican perspective where people were hurt or damaged by the state or agents of the state. But we have to find a way to get ourselves through all of this. And I find when I'm going around engaging with people, including people from the unionist community, society wants to move on in many ways it has. That's not to deny that there are people who are hurt and are still hurting and they need support and they need mechanisms to try and deal with that legacy of the conflict. And that's why we have applied not just over the last year, but over the last 4 or 5 years, a recognition among all the parties and the government, the two governments, that we need to come up with mechanisms to deal with this. We need the British government to cross that last line to get those mechanisms up and working. That's not to say that they will deal with every single issue and every single individual who's been affected, but we have to try and do it as best we possibly can. And it's not about drawing a line under the past. It's not about saying those incidents are gone, you can no longer remember them, but it's trying to assist people through the ongoing pain that they feel in relation to any of those incidents.
And will the IRA be telling the truth about the past?
Yes, absolutely.
Will
Republicans have committed in the truth recovery mechanism to step up to the plate and do that. I can't force every individual, but I can say that certainly our engagement with people involved in republicanism is a willingness for people to step forward and play their part in relation to that.
Let's move on. In the UTV debate last night, Arlene Foster, the DUP leader, mentioned Gerry Adams Sinn Féin on a number of occasions.
Yes.
Is there any difference between Gerry Adams Sinn Féin and Michelle O'Neill's Sinn Féin?
No. I mean, it was quite obvious. And I mean, I watched the Twitter feeds in relation to all that and the commentary. And, you know, I think what Arlene Foster was trying to do is to resurrect some sort of a bogeyman to deflect unionist attention from RHI and the DUP's involvement in it, and to try and get them to vote along tribal lines. The very thing that the guy who stopped me from East Belfast said, those people around our area beating the drum, waving the red, white and blue, and we're fed up with it. We're actually voting Sinn Féin tactically this time. I think people in the unionist community see through that Gerry Adams Sinn Féin, it used to be Sinn Féin IRA, now it's Gerry Adams Sinn Féin. The reality is that we have a collective leadership. Gerry Adams is our president. Michelle O'Neill is part of our collective leadership. And that's the way it has been north and south. And we have made our contribution to the peace process and our contribution to trying to move politics forward in this island.